Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, Gabe Bullard finds out if Kentucky could be the next hot spot for wine grapes. First, women in the United States make an average of 77 cents for each dollar that men make, a fact that pay equality activists are trying to change. Laura Ellis spoke with Phyllis Hargrave, president of Business and Professional Women of River City, about the lingering pay gap and the passage last week of Equal Pay Day.
This past Tuesday, April 22nd, was Equal Pay Day. I was wondering if you could just kind of explain to us the symbolism of that day and what it is.
Equal Pay Day is a day that across the nation, women and women's organizations and others recognize as the day that a woman has to work through in the current year to make up for all the money a man made the previous year. For example, a man might have made, let's say, $30,000 in 2007. A woman from the beginning of 2007 until April 22nd of 2008, it would take her that long to make that same $30,000 because women generally, not always, but generally, make about 77 cents on the dollar compared to a male.
And do we have local or statewide figures on that, or is that a national average?
Actually, statewide in Kentucky, women generally make a little less than the national level. That is a national 77 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm. And so the disparity is bigger here, actually, than it is?
It is. Mm-hmm. And then it depends on the race. Some races actually make less than that. Asians make less. Women who are African American make less. Spanish make even less.
Does the pay disparity affect blue-collar workers and white-collar workers similarly?
Not always, but similarly, yes. It is bigger, I think, with blue-collar, but you can have somebody come right out of college and make less than a female, make less than a male.
Okay, if I could just play devil's advocate for a second.
Okay.
I've heard people argue on the other side that the reason why women tend to make less money than men is because they take more time off.
Well, okay, if a woman's going to have a baby, that's fine. She's going to be out for 6 weeks or so and then come back to work. That's no excuse because if a man has to have prostate surgery and he's out for 4 to 6 weeks and come back to work, are they going to penalize him for having surgery and being off? No. If a woman takes time off from her career to raise children and then goes back to work, she is often penalized for that, and that's not fair to say, well, you don't have the same credentials as a man who's been here the whole time. If everything's equal in a real world, if their education is the same, if their experience is the same, if their knowledge is the same, their ability is the same, we'd like to see them paid the same no matter what time they take off for whatever medical reason.
And this week, the Fair Pay Restoration Act was debated in the Senate, and the bill was kind of a response to the 2007 Supreme Court case involving Lilly Ledbetter.
Yes.
Could you give us some background on that case?
Lilly Ledbetter worked for Goodyear, and she had been there a number of years and found out that she was actually being paid about 20% less than her male counterparts doing the same work. She filed an EEO complaint that ended up going through the court system. All the lower courts agreed with her that the way the law was written, every time she got a paycheck, it was a new incident of her being discriminated against and being paid less than her male counterparts. The Supreme Court finally got this case, and they overruled all the lower courts, saying that her claim was not filed within 180 days of Goodyear's initial discriminatory pay decision, and therefore it was not valid. So they're saying that basically because she didn't file it within 180 days of when she initially got paid that 20% less than a man years before, it was null and valid claim. And before that, it was from the date of the incident of the paycheck. Mm-hmm. So the Ledbetter law that's in Congress now is trying to rescind or override the Supreme Court ruling.
And so under the old system, it was 180 days from when, I guess, they decided how much to pay the person.
From each paycheck.
And the issue was that she didn't find out about the disparity?
Well,
within that time frame?
Well, the issue was that they said that it was from the initial time of when she first got her first paycheck and not her reoccurring paycheck every 2 weeks or every month when she got paid. And that was Supreme Court ruling that said, no, you can't go back to the beginning of her time of employment. You can only go back to when her check was from when she filed this complaint. It really hurt her over a series of 20 years to be paid 20%, or however many number of years it was, to be paid 20% less than the man.
What should someone do if they suspect that there's a pay disparity situation going on at their place of employment?
Well, I think they could talk to their employer. They may have to go with an EEO complaint. I think the way companies are structured so much now, it's really hard to know when you are not being paid the same as a man. I think what I understand was Lily Ledbetter, in her case, someone anonymously gave her a note. And then she went back to her HR department and found that it was true that she was being paid 20% less. That's a big chunk of change. And you're just going to have to plead your case. And if they go on deaf ears right now, except for filing a complaint, maybe changing employers, which is a drastic move.
And as you said, the bill was before the Senate, and it was filibustered. I'm wondering if you have an idea of what the next step should be.
Well, I think a little logic should go into place here. Common sense tells you that they ought to look at this on a logical platform and decide the best thing to do is allow this law to be rescinded back to what the initial intent was, that it would go to the first day of when the discrimination occurred, not from the time she got her last paycheck.
What would you encourage the average person to do? What can the average person do to address this?
Well, the average person ought to write their congressman and tell them to support the Ledbetter Pay Act for equal pay. I know a lot of companies say we can't afford to pay a woman the same as we pay a man. Then my thought is just make it equal and pay a man less. Every time I say that, I get a reaction. And a lot of times people will almost jerk back because it's just such an odd idea for them to pay a man less. But here's my thought. Most families in this country that are run by single parents are run by single females. When they're paid less, that affects that whole family, the economics of the whole community. If you pay a woman the same as a man, then you're going to possibly have more tax money coming into the community, the state, the nation. You're going to have hopefully less people on welfare. You're going to have a better economic situation for children in that family. It just makes economic sense to pay people equal when all things are equal, their education, their experience, their job knowledge. Now, if things aren't equal, of course they should not be paid the same. But when they are, just pay everyone a fair and equal wage.
For much of the 20th century, tobacco was a profitable crop for small farms in Kentucky. But with the tobacco market shrinking and years after the government discontinued subsidies for growing it, small farmers are looking to diversify, and some of them have turned to wine. Gabe Bullard has more on the potential for grapes to replace tobacco in Kentucky agriculture.
This is our operation. You can see this 26, 27 acres of grapes.
Next to tobacco and hay fields in southern Jefferson County, Jerry Kushner runs Broad Run Winery. Kushner opened Broad Run 15 years ago after spending more than 20 years growing and selling grapes in Kentucky.
When we started our winery, there were three wineries in Kentucky, and they all started the same year. And now there's roughly 50. They just pop up all the time now.
They're popping up in part because the University of Kentucky has been helping tobacco farmers turn their fields into vineyards. It's a program UK viticulture specialist Con Kutteral says has been very successful.
It's one of the fastest growing states in the union. From like 90 acres of our commercial vineyards, we have surpassed 700 acres in a matter of 3 years. I think we will top out around 1,500 acres by 2015.
You know, everybody's talking about replacing tobacco with grapes. Well, that's a wonderful idea on paper. And it would be wonderful if it could happen.
Jeff Tatman used to grow tobacco. Now he makes wine at Felicia in downtown Louisville. He says a lot of the new vineyards in Kentucky grow American-style grapes, which in his view results in second-class wine.
A lot of people, I think, in the state have rushed into American variety grapes. It's just that, you know, you, no matter how much lipstick you put on a pig, you've still got a pig.
Jerry Kushner agrees. He laments the fact that UK encourages farmers to grow domestic grapes instead of the more sought-after European varieties.
They claim they're more delicate and this and that, but we've never lost any of those and had the others survive, so we feel that they're just as easy to grow and in some places easier. In fact, for years, University of Kentucky people said, well, we're growing up here, it's impossible to grow. And we've been growing them for 26 years.
Kushner says Kentucky has a climate and soil suited for European breeds. The state was once the site of America's first commercial vineyard and was a leader in grape production prior to Prohibition.
We can grow a perfectly balanced grape. In other words, its pH is in the ideal range, its sugar's in the ideal range, its acid's in the ideal range, provided we don't have too much rain.
Kushner says the European grapes make better wine, and wine is where the real money is for grape growers.
And when you take the grapes and convert it to wine, you can add anywhere from 8 to 15 times, even maybe higher than that value.
Stereotypes about Kentucky make it difficult for Kushner to get the full value from his crop. He says he realized this when a Chicago expert took a bottle of his Broad Run wine to the West Coast.
He took some of the wine out to California to have some people taste it out there, and they loved it, and because it was a blind tasting. And then when he showed them it came from Kentucky, they said, well, the wine was good, but it didn't come from Kentucky. So Kentucky has a tremendous image problem.
Kushner thinks high-quality wine production and state support will fix that image. But Kentucky's in a budget crunch, and vineyards take about 5 years to start turning out quality wine from European grapes. In the meantime, Louisville winemaker Jeff Tatman says local vineyards should aim for the tourism market.
That's going to be the biggest angle for Kentucky wineries. A lot of people love to go out to the wineries and walk around through the vines, and you can sell a lot of wine right at the point, you know, right at that point. And I think that's going to be the angle the Kentucky wineries really need to take.
Kentucky law prohibits the sale of wine in grocery stores. So for Tatman's urban winery, on-site sales are key.
You know, I'm not even thinking about the other Kentucky wineries, I mean, because you've got a liquor store every 8 or 10 blocks. So my competition is Australia and California and Europe and, you know, Argentina, you name it.
Winemakers have been pushing for a bill that would allow wine sales in grocery stores, which Kushner says would give him and other small producers a boost.
You know, the more outlets you have, the more wine you're going to sell. We'd have at least between 400 and 700 more outlets if we could sell it in the grocery stores.
But even if wine could be sold in grocery stores, it still wouldn't be legally available to many Kentuckians. 54 of the state's 120 counties are dry. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
One of Louisville's oldest neighborhoods is working to revitalize itself, and art is playing a role. Elizabeth Kramer explored Portland for this report.
Historian Rick Bell points to features along the Ohio from the cupola atop the Marine Hospital in Louisville's Portland neighborhood.
If you look straight across, you see the Falls of the Ohio Center, and every bridge. You can see every bridge in the city of Louisville from this one room. And I think it's the only place in the city you can do that.
Bell is head of the foundation that is helping renovate this National Historic Landmark, which was built in 1852 during Portland's heyday. In that era of steamships, this neighborhood was a hub of the nation's river trading economy. Today, I-64 cuts through Portland, where according to the 2000 census, more than 30% of residents live in poverty, and 13% of its housing is unoccupied. Despite these numbers, there is artistic activity in this corner of the neighborhood just west of 22nd Street.
Places!
In the hospital's basement, a local theater company is performing new plays.
Something's just not right.
The performances bring out locals and attract audiences from outside the neighborhood. Across the street of Portland Avenue, there is the Portland Museum and, two doors down, a former medical clinic that local artist Bryce Hudson recently transformed into a contemporary art gallery. Here, he creates his own work and displays art by regional artists. Hudson is optimistic about Portland's rich history and its potential for revitalization.
If I can slowly but surely build something that helps build a community and maybe helps get some more artists and art types down here, then you never know. Maybe this will become the next hot spot. I mean, of course, it's years and years and years down the line, but it's a start.
Hudson's idea of revitalizing community through art dovetails with the views of sociologist and Vanderbilt University assistant professor Richard Lloyd. In his book, Neo-Bohemia, Art and Commerce in the Post-Industrial City, Lloyd writes about how urban neighborhoods have attracted young creative people who grew up in suburbia and helped transform economies. Lloyd says these areas attract creative types for specific reasons.
Artists are very attracted to urban neighborhoods for the sense of history and the aura of authenticity that confers.
Members of the neighborhood group called Portland Now say they definitely hope that more people like Bryce Hudson open businesses and make homes in their neighborhood. Still, they recognize there are many other components to renewing Portland.
We got Bryce. He's moved in. That's wonderful. But what else is going to be there?
That's Deb Mercer, a member of Portland Now. She led the group in putting together a neighborhood plan, a process that began in 2004. In March, the Louisville Metro Council approved the plan, which recommends zoning changes designed to promote the neighborhood's history while encouraging residential and business development that could alleviate poverty. Mercer says land use is a major issue in the neighborhood.
It's a big old circle. If you improve your housing stock, maybe get a few people to appreciate it, get people more concerned with the neighborhood, then you get people in that maybe then have kids and then are concerned about the schools, and then your schools improve. Because it takes, you know, it takes a lot of people to make big changes.
While those changes promise to be slow in coming, architect and history buff Steve Weiser says they will come. As a member of the American Institute of Architects Louisville chapter, Weiser worked with Portland Now in considering how to make the I-64 exit ramp area near the Marine Hospital more inviting to passersby. That experience helped him form ideas about how the neighborhood will play in the city in 25 years, as outlined in his recently published book, Louisville 2035.
I realized that here was a phenomenal, affordable district near downtown that is on the cusp of revitalization. And so with the increases of gasoline prices, people wanting shorter commutes to work, younger professionals, and the affordable housing that the Portland district has, I really do see over the next 25 years as Portland being a hot place, people wanting to live and work.
Portland Now's Deb Mercer and artist Bryce Hudson say they want to believe in Weiser's predictions. They caution the community to approach that future in baby steps that will allow it to improve existing housing, preserve historic housing, create attractive areas with artists and parks, and, of course, attract business. They say that the development of Portland will benefit Louisville overall. Hudson suggests the next step.
What I think Louisville needs is somebody opening up a really nice business on Portland Avenue. I think just getting people down to Portland that normally would never step foot west of 9th Street, that's what I think Louisville needs.
For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
When we come back, New York Times writer Joe Drape joins us to talk about horse racing and past Triple Crown winners. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, more on the latest art exhibit at the Speed Museum. But first, as we approach Kentucky Derby Day, many horse racing fans are wondering if this will be the year for a Triple Crown winner. No Derby champion has gone on to win the Preakness and the Belmont Stakes since 1978, and there have been only 11 Triple Crown winners since 1919. New York Times sports writer Joe Drape has dug into the archives and compiled a book of stories about those 11 champions, as seen through the eyes of some of racing's greatest scribes. It's called To the Swift, Classic Triple Crown Horses and Their Race for Glory. I talked to Joe Drape about the book and the odds of seeing a Triple Crown champion in 2008. You really have a Hall of Fame cast of contributors here.
Yeah, it's Rick, I was just looking at this again. We have three of the four sports writers who won Pulitzers involved here. Red Smith, of course, Dave Anderson, and Arthur Daly, who were all columnists for the Times. for your listeners out there, the fourth sports writer is Jim Murray from the LA Times. We've got Jane Smiley, another Pulitzer winner, who's written two horse books. Hillenbrand, Laura, of course, of Seabiscuit. Steve Crist is the editor and publisher of the Daily Racing Form. Jim Squires has won 17 Pulitzers as an editor at Chicago and Orlando. He bred Monarcos. I mean, I'm really kind of proud of the company I'm keeping here. This is totally a grade one group right here.
So do you match up a Triple Crown winner with a contributor? Is that how this works?
You know, I basically said there was going to be no wrong answer here, and I contacted all these people that we added new essays for, and I said, what do you want to write about? And all had separate different ideas. And then I just sort of organized it a little bit in what I think are the three great epics of the Triple Crown, and epics meaning periods of time. It was early on, it was the old-time industrialists, and this was their playpen. When you got Assault came around in the 30s, you started to see the rock star horse or the box office horse. And then, you know, you have the 70s, which are no doubt the golden age of horse racing, and then on through there. So, you know, I just stayed out of the way, let all this great writing speak for itself.
It's hard to believe it's been 30 years now since we had a Triple Crown winner.
30 years since Affirmed. And, you know, every year I have Save Get on my on my computer. It's since 1978 when Affirmed did so. And, you know, I personally have been writing that for 10 years. This is my 10th year on the beat. I keep saying, threatening, swearing that I'm going to get off the beat as soon as I write that Sunday Triple Crown story. And, you know, I've been close, what, six times here in the last 10 years?
I was going to say, we've had some very close calls.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, in the greatest, and this is in To the Swift, too, to me, the greatest beat in all of sports was Real Quiet losing that Belmont race.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was by a nose. So much was on the line. You can argue DeSorma left him go too early. Mike Pegram told me that, you know, he's a sportsman. He gets it. And he was very gracious and very dignified afterwards. He said the following year he was at the Derby Museum, and you know how they have that circularama there?
Yes.
He said, you know, I'm standing in the middle of it, watching it like I do every year, and I see Real Quiet cross, and he goes, I just started bursting out in tears.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that was the moment I realized that I was a nose from history, a nostril from history.
What is it that makes it so elusive? Is it that last bit of that last fourth of a mile at Belmont?
You know, it's a last fourth of the mile at Belmont, of course. It's, you know, historically, they're not breeding them like they used to. They're not campaigning them like they used to. You know, Smarty Jones, I'm convinced, I'm kind of old school. I think the gods are going to allow a deserving horse in. And Smarty Jones, as good as he was, I said this on a radio show the day before the Belmont. I said, you know what's going to keep him out is his name. You know, think about it. War Admiral, Sir Barton, Secretariat, Affirmed, Seattle Slough, and then you're going to have Smarty Jones in there.
Doesn't quite fit.
No, it doesn't quite fit. So, you know, I think a bunch of things have taken precedent here. You know, at this time of year, everybody really kind of gets anxious for it. Right now, Big Brown's probably the only deserving one we can talk Triple Crown with. I mean, he comes in undefeated. He comes in really never threatened. You know, the rest of them, you can draw a line through one or two races in their PPs because, you know, they got crushed and there was really no excuse. Warpass, you know, he came up injured. He was going to be the lone speed on the engine there, but he's not there anymore. It's really a tricky year. I usually by this time I have a strong opinion about the Derby. That's usually the wrong opinion, but it's at least a strong opinion, and I have six or seven or eight horses that I'm playing with that I think, okay, you know, they can win it. I am just totally befuddled this year. I don't love anybody. I'm not really even sure that there's four great horses there. I'm thinking this isn't the best three-year-old crop we've seen in a long time. And I'm looking for magic in the next 2 weeks here.
Do you have a favorite story in the book?
You know, I do like this favorite story. I have a couple ones. The first one, and I especially to your listeners, does crack me up. You know, the Kentucky Derby. Here we are in the 134th year. You know, it's America's greatest race, the famous Twin Spires, you know, name all that stuff. When that race was first won, we have a story. It's on the front page because in those days, in 1875, May 17th, in those days, all racing went on the front page of the Times, believe it or not. You know, small stories, but it'd be from all over the country. And it, basically, the first Kentucky Derby is described this way. The great event of the day was the Kentucky Derby, which was won by Aristides, making the fastest time ever made by a three-year-old. And is only second to the time made by Tom Bowling. Altogether, today's meeting was extraordinarily successful. That's it. It's like it's three paragraphs that basically says, you know, they made up this race called the Kentucky Derby. This horse won. It was pretty good. That's it. And, you know, from there, we're going to have 200,000 people coming through there this weekend between the Oaks and the Derby.
Yeah.
You know, a couple things. A buddy of mine just pointed out a Red Smith. All the Red Smith stuff is really delightful, and it's salty. And John Veach, the great trainer of Ali Dar, is Red Smith asks him, you know, were you always going to be a trainer? He goes, yep. Because were you going to be a, what about a policeman, a firefighter, or a ball player? And Veach says, nope, ball players don't make any money. So, you know, think about that. That's the 1970s, and, you know, horse trainers were making more dough than ball players. And you know, the other line that just made me laugh out loud every time I stumble upon it is Red's talking about how horses, experts are picking apart a horse's performance, and he's dismissing them. He says, you know, horse experts are baseball writers with binoculars. So there's just some wonderful stuff in here.
Now, you're we'll be airing this on the Sunday prior to the Derby. So is that when you come out? You come out a few days early?
Yeah. You know, I'm one of the throngs that go out there, and I'll be going out there the next week every morning, you know, 6 to 9 o'clock, trying to look at these horses in the eye and have one of them tell me they're going to run fastest of all. And there's about 3,000 of us out there doing it. So, you know, it never really works that well, but you can learn a little bit of thing. It's sort of the vibes. All the horsemen will tell you, way more qualified folks than I, that last week before the Derby is truly the key. It's when the three-year-olds either grow up and decide that they are racehorses and they are healthy and everything that's come before has gotten them there. And, you know, quite often they fall apart that last week, you know. The little pastern that they'd been nursing all of a sudden gets very sore, feed issues, you know, and just the tension of the week going up there. So you do keep a good eye on what's going on in the mornings out there in Churchill.
I guess the racing gods have to smile on you a little bit, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, in my tenor, Point Given was probably the top three or four horses I've seen in the last 10 years. And, you know, he was the big favorite there in the Derby, and he comes up with a pastern in that final week and finishes third. You know, he should have won that race. Fleet Alex, he gets unlucky, gets stuck in traffic. Everything's got to go right. These guys will tell you. I mean, you know, I feel for these the trainers more than the riders, because the riders, you know, there's always going to be another chance for them.
Yeah.
The trainers who come there with horses that they think they're going to get their Derby with, and, you know, in the last minute they get beat, something happens. You know, it's a rough game for them.
So the book's available everywhere now?
The book is available everywhere right now, and, you know, anybody, like I said, anybody who loves horses wants this in their library. And, you know, I'm not even selling it to get rich. This has really been a joy to do. I just got to muck around in our archives for 130 years and read all these guys I had heard about early on and read when I was a kid. And it's, you know, about a game I'm passionate about. So To the Swift is definitely worth your time.
Great. Well, To the Swift is the name of the book. The Triple Crown Horses and Their Race for Glory. Joe Drape compiled it, put it together. Joe, thanks for joining us today. We look forward to meeting you at the track.
See you, and good luck. I hope you get yourself a winner.
Joe Drape writes about horse racing for the New York Times. The Speed Art Museum opened an exhibit this week with work by an Austrian artist who wants to provoke people. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
On Main and 7th Streets in downtown Louisville is a peculiar artwork, a flamboyant chandelier suspended from a pole resembling the kind that holds a hangman's noose. When an unsuspecting pedestrian passes underneath, it comes to life as the sound is accompanied by flashing lights. This afternoon, that pedestrian is Sean Renelow of New York.
My first thought initially is somebody who's trying to play some kind of an elaborate prank on the city.
The prankster in this case is Austrian artist Werner Reiterer, who created and installed this massive work here 2 years ago. Reiterer says making public art gives him a thrill.
In the public space, you can irritate lots of people.
This week, Reiterer was back in Louisville for an exhibit of his work at the Speed Art Museum and ready to irritate and amuse with sculptures and drawings. All portray absurdity in the vein of Gary Larson's Far Side comics. There's a drum pedal attached to a large white box. Press the pedal, and instead of a drum beat, you hear a gong. Next to a nearby wall sits a slouching, life-size figure of a man. Reiterer walks by, triggering a motion detector. The man seems to breathe as a bag over his head fills with air.
It's called Raw Loop because it also it's focusing those basics of our life, and that's breathing. You do it in a loop your whole life. I mean, you never stop breathing.
Reiterer says one museum worker suggested it was about Guantanamo Bay prison. Another linked the piece to unrest in Tibet. The artist says he wants to provoke people into thinking in new ways.
You can irritate the people, and also a project, a process of, I would say, education and learning about the world.
Having an exhibit of Reiterer's work was the idea of curator Julian Robson. He likens the artist's approach to that of Marcel Duchamp, who in 1917 turned a urinal on its side in Paris and dubbed the artwork Fountain. Robson says Reiterer's work often uses modern technology to give objects new meanings. The art's interactive nature fits into Robson's efforts to present exhibits that are far from solemn affairs.
I've been really interested in how do we go around changing the way that an exhibition is created and presented.
The crowd is far from somber at this week's opening, and the scene has Robson and Reiterer smiling. In a piece called Come Closer to Leave, a voice from a wall of speakers beckons visitors to approach before berating them.
Are you silly? Go away, you... Leave me alone.
Local sculptor Brad Meredith endured a round of insults.
The speaker wall over here, when you walk in front of, has some profane comments, and that really startled me. But there seems to be a tie of humor involved in all of his work.
The humor is what people notice first, but the work also has an underlying tone of angst and aggression. The exhibit, called Raw Loop, is at the Speed Art Museum through June 29th. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
When we come back, we'll learn more about Actors Theater's production of Doubt. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with Will Rogers biographer Richard Maturi. First, John Patrick Shanley's Doubt is one of the most critically acclaimed plays of the last decade. It won the 2005 Tony Award for Best Play and the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. It has had more than 600 performances this year alone and more than 500 during its Broadway run in the 2005-2006 season. The director for the production at Actors Theater of Louisville is Wendy Goldberg. She discussed her production of Doubt with Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum.
Doubt is a play that just a few years ago won every major award for American playwriting, won the Pulitzer, won the Tony Award for the Best New Play. And this particular season is the first time that the regional rights to the piece has been available. And in fact, that has resulted in the most productions of a play around the country. There are 36 productions of Doubt that are taking place at different points throughout this particular theatrical season. And I have a feeling that we might be one of the last productions in Louisville since the season is coming to a close. But The play is unbelievably powerful, and it is the story of a Catholic school in 1964 where a nun suspects a priest of having an inappropriate relationship with a young male student there in the school. And the play really explores what it means to be unsure, because the sister, it takes place in a Sister of Charity school in the Bronx, New York, in 64. She truly has no evidence for this particular event. She just has suspicions. And what we're looking at in the play is we're looking at how uncomfortable it is to live in a place of uncertainty and how we all want to rush to some kind of, black or white place as opposed to ever living in a gray zone. And the play really looks at, it's a very tautly constructed play with just four actors, and it looks at this conflict of the nun accusing the priest of this act. And then really what happens from then on out is about, how are we sure? What happens when we're unsure? And we're looking at something, of course, in recent times we've become really aware of all of the corruption and scandal in the Catholic Church around this issue. And, of course, in 64, it was really unknown. We have to remember that when we're looking at this play, when we see it as an audience, we're looking at it with contemporary perspective. But I think it's really important to think a little bit about what it would be like to be in that particular time. And I know so many of us have connections back to that time. So many people went to schools like this school. Mm-hmm. So I ask people to remember what it was like to be a student and how so much of this information was not part of the culture of that time.
As you mentioned, it's been getting a lot of performances, over 500 in the preceding 10 years, fifth longest running Broadway play or something. What is the attraction to the play? Is it the material, or is it the writing itself?
I think it's both, absolutely both. But I also think it's this notion of asking an audience to wrestle with a challenging topic. And because the play is so perfectly balanced, I think it's even more balanced than I had thought of when I did see the production on Broadway. And I think, you inherently want to take a side. And what you realize once you really get inside the play in the way that we've had to get inside the play to work on it is that it's any time there's an argument for one side, there's an equally weighted argument on the other side. And it's just a beautifully constructed piece, which really does keep you guessing, mm-hmm. and it allows you throughout the course of the play to shift your allegiances, and then allows you, allows the audience to really kind of do their own discussion and work and thinking. It doesn't do all the work for you.
Sure.
So I think that it provokes a lot of conversation, and it happens to be, a very challenging topic, but it's done in a way that there's an equal humorous release in it. There's a lot of comedy in the play. And so it's just he's such a brilliant craftsman. It's put together just gorgeously. So I think that audiences really respond to all of these things.
Is this your first time working with the works of John Patrick Shanley?
It is. I've had the opportunity to meet him. I work, I run the National Playwrights Conference at the O'Neill. And I did have an opportunity to meet him because he came on campus to do a speaking event, and we actually have had a meal together. But in terms of directing his plays, this is my first opportunity. And we did converse through email about questions that I had and things like that. I come from a place where, if the writer's alive and I have an opportunity to speak to them, I always try to include them in the process a little bit. So we did have a chance to speak a little bit about things, but this is my first time working on his material.
That was Wendy Goldberg, the director of Doubt, a play by John Patrick Shanley, currently running at Actors Theater of Louisville. Shanley's drama was the 2005 Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award winner. Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum recently spoke with Wendy Goldberg from New York about that production, which runs through May 10th. Will Rogers was truly a man for all seasons. He was a cowboy, a newspaper columnist, vaudeville performer, movie actor, amateur pilot. You name it, he did it. And he did it all with a grace and humor the American people loved. With over 90 books written about Rogers, author Richard Maturi chose to write about Rogers' career as a performer. Robin Fisher spoke with Maturi about his latest book, Will Rogers, Performer.
My knowledge of Will Rogers, before I read your book, was limited to the Will Rogers Follies. So I bet I'm not the only one. I wondered if you could start out by giving us a little general background on Rogers.
Well, that's one of the reasons that we wrote the book and expanded it, is that a lot of people don't know of Will because he died back in 1935. And you can kind of compare him to people like Mark Twain, who was a humorist and kind of a political satirist at the same time. And he started out, you know, on the Wild West shows and progressed to vaudeville, Ziegfeld Follies, which you know, the theater production was based on. And then he got into the talkies, 48 Silence, silent films, and 21 talkies or squawkies, as he called them.
How did you first become interested in Will Rogers?
Well, when I was a kid growing up, we had a library in our home, and my dad was a small plane pilot, so he had a lot of books on aviation and also on Will Rogers. So as a kid, I just, you know, I read many of those books a number of times, and I was just in awe of Will's just common sense and his humor. And when we became writers decades later, it was a natural topic.
Well, there was so much to him, and, you know, some of his quotes, as you know, are laugh-out-loud funny, or they're just so close to the truth that they're funny and uncomfortable at the same time. But you chose to focus on his career as a performer. And was that simply because you couldn't cover everything?
Well, there's probably 90 or more books out on Will Rogers, and a lot of them cover his life in general, but a lot of people don't realize that how big a performer Will was, not only in the movies, but on radio and vaudeville, and he covered every medium there was at the time, and if he was around today, he'd probably be on blogs and YouTube. So, you know, that's why we focus on that, because it was an area that wasn't very widely covered.
Can you take us briefly through a timeline of his stage, screen, and radio careers? Did he start in radio, or did he start everything all at one time? Or
well, his first earning money was $20 a week when he was doing steer roping contests for Zach Mulhall's Wild West troupe, and then he went in 1902. He went to South Africa and South America, and was with Texas Jack Wild West Show. He entered vaudeville in 1904, just, you know, twirling his rope, doing rope tricks, and then once in a while he kind of thrown it in an ad lib, and then people really liked that, and that's when he started becoming a humorist. And from 1904, he was making $140 a week. By 1915, he was working for Ziegfeld Follies, and later on, when he was working for Ziegfeld, he was making $500,000 a year from the Follies, $150,000 for movies, and $1,500 a night for speaking engagements. And that was just in, you know, about a 15-year period. And from the Follies, he went into did a film for Sam Goldwyn, 1918. And by the time he died in 1935, he was the number one box office draw, outdrawing Shirley Temple and Clark Gable.
What did he do for the Follies? Because we know he wasn't a dancer.
No, he did the lasso tricks, and he did rope tricks, and then did his standard saying was, "All I know is what I read in the papers," and he would comment on, you know, the political situation of the day, or what was happening in the news in that tongue that he was performing at, and he always liked the kid that. Ziegfeld only had him in the Follies so that the girls could change from nothing to nothing.
When he was in the movies, he went from being in front of the camera to behind the camera.
Yes, in the 20s, he started his own production company, and that was probably the one mistake he made, is that he actually lost quite a bit of money producing some of his own films. But he did do some breakthrough photography. It was his first use of time-lapse photography when he did The Roping Fool.
When he went behind the camera, did it change his perspective of the industry?
No, I don't think so. Will was just who he was, and you know, whether he was with the average person or kings or queens, or whether he was running a show or just being an actor taking directions, he was just who he was.
He made over 70 movies, both silent and talkies.
Yes.
How were they viewed by the critics then, and is there a difference now?
I think they were very well received, and we put a lot of quotes from the reviews of the day, and a lot of them came out through the Depression, and where people were needing laughter in their lives, And so he was very timely in that respect. And until recently, there was only one or two of Will's movies out on the market, and Fox is just starting to re-release them so they can be shown on Turner Classic Movies and on CDs and DVDs. So, you know, there's no real critical claim at this point because they're just coming back out to the market, but I think people will really enjoy them.
Now, your book has a lot of quotes, both of Will Rogers and then, as you mentioned, from the critics, but it is loaded with photographs.
Yeah, we worked with the Will Rogers Memorial down in Claremore, and they were just super people. We've known three of the directors there over the years, and they provided us with any films that photos that they had, and we also, you know, acquired some on eBay and through private collections. But you know, what we did is we've gone through the other books, and we tried to use in the main photos that have not used in other books. So many of these have only been seen in the newspapers when they first came out. And not elsewhere.
Well, they're really amazing because you see him age and you see him change throughout the book.
Yes, and then one of the sections we added to the paperback is his love of aviation. It's called Will Rogers, Aviation Enthusiast, and you'll see him with Lindbergh and Roscoe Turner and all the great aviators of the day. And he actually took his first flight in 1915, and he logged 500,000 miles flying by the time they crashed in Alaska. And that, you know, that's an amazing number of miles for those days.
Now, in all his performing, did he have a preference, whether it was stage, screen, or radio?
I think he just enjoyed what he was doing at the time. I know he really loved his time at the Ziegfeld Follies. Was very special to him. I'd say probably his least favorite, as far as the people he was dealing with, was probably Hollywood. And he and his kids, who were in some of his movies, typically hung out with the stagehands and the extras rather than the Hollywood people. But he was a really good friend with Douglas Fairbanks.
You know, you mentioned his kids, and there is a wonderful introduction to the book written by Wilson Jim Rogers. And it sounds like he was such a family man, which is amazing to me that he found the time to be devoted to his family and be involved in everything.
Yeah, this is a great quote. We talked with Jim Rogers at his ranch in California and then also several times at in Claremore. And he told us when his dad died, he didn't realize how famous he was. He was just dad. And he had a friend in high school that had a father that wrote a column, and he always read his other friend's column, father's column, rather than his own. You know, he just thought that was just dad. So, you know, I think that really portrays what the quality of man he was, just because he was on the road a lot of demands on his time, but he was, you know, number one, he was a family man.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much, Robin, for your interest in Will. He's just a great person.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Richard Maturi, co-author of Will Rogers, Performer. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.